is based upon the effects that the person suffers from in the present. And because of that, he really isn't capable of preparing for a future that exists in reality. He only sees that which draws him at the moment. It's an interesting thing. The philosophers always had a big debate. Philosophers had a debate about this very problem. But let me just point out one thing. What is he basically saying here? What is the Bainiyana basically saying? He says, Ki Yish Raya Shechosh Kalibah Vein Rami Yeloi Bacha Sayon. Okay. So why can't he... So he doesn't see what's going to happen in the future. Okay, true.
Yeah.
Even though it's coming, he says, even the Bainiyana says, even if she loves him, and he doesn't love her, says bad mazel, mazel or ragar shalzei ish garim shetachash gibo. It still is. He still is trapped. Still is trapped. Okay. Yeah. Doesn't make any sense to me. If he doesn't love her, so what's the? What does it mean?
Yeah.
That's right. He means like this. There's two ways that the tivus, the person gets caught by the tivus. One way, and this is usually where a person is unsatisfied. So how does he satisfy his taivas? He satisfies his taivas by searching out for a taiva. He goes actively and searches out. Wants to get this, wants to get that. Start looking around for different things. Different ways to expend his energy. That's the first way. Right? But there's another way that the taivas get a person. A person's walking down the street one day, and all of a sudden something happens. He meets somebody or something. And they set him up with a tremendous deal. All of a sudden, he gets pulled. He gets drawn. Hey, this is wasn't looking for anything. It's just Mosley or Garab. Feels very lucky. He gets drawn from the outside. He gets drawn from the outside. Even then, even though he wasn't initially looking for it, but he gets drawn. He gets pulled into it. He gets caught in the trap. Then what's the next thing? Asurim yadeo. She'im ochaza biyadeo. If she grabbed with her hands, took around with her hands, kvar lakuach hu beves asurim. He is in jail. L'shuv ein lo takana. And after that, there's nothing he can do. Right. So what's the pshat? That's it. Once you're in that state, in other words, he's saying, that's right, exactly. What Bainiyana says is that once a person is in a certain state, there are states in which a person has no bechira. That's what it means. That the emotion is so overpowering that he absolutely cannot exert bechira at the time. There's no way he can do it. So that's why it says, the end of the pasuk is, Tevufnei Elokim Yimolek Mimeno, V'chote Yilochet Ba. That the only way is, if the guy escapes, he has to use every bit of knowledge that he has, all his abilities, to prevent the such an occurrence. But once he's caught there, there's no way he can escape. He has no bechira anymore. That's it.
So we were discussing
the idea of bechira, and we were discussing the fact that what Rabbi Yehuda says, in many instances you're not under bechira. In the case with Yosef HaTzadik, by Yosef HaTzadik, he already committed himself to performing the Avera. And he would have lost his Bechira, really. At that moment, he didn't have Bechira. But something occurred, which made it possible for him to exert the Bechira. And therefore, a question was raised that is it not true that a person's neuroses, in many instances, will help him towards making a correct decision and escaping avera? Because we could see how a person, for instance, who has a lot of guilt, in certain instances, if he's about to perform an avera, he's liable to get a guilt attack. This will help. So therefore, we would recommend neuroses. Yeah, the answer is like this. That's just like saying a person who's crippled, his physical defect will prevent them from doing an avera. Why? Because since he's crippled, he can't go anywhere. So you really limited his chances to do any performances. So already, I mean, he can't be either the isser of of Ritzas Raglayam Lahara. I mean, it's impossible. Right? same thing is true about a person with a crippled psyche. A person with a crippled psyche, it's true, will be prevented from doing averis in certain instances. Just like any crippling of the mechanism will prevent the mechanism from functioning. And therefore, if the function could have been for evil, so then it won't be able to do it. But the truth of the matter is that it will not lead him to perfection.
And it will also lead him into harm sometimes.
Like this. So the point is that, you see, what is perfection really? Perfection really, in Yahadus, is not where a person does certain religious actions, but where a person's energy is freed so that it can be used for a higher activity. See? Now, insofar as a person has a neurosis, he does not have free energy. What he has is a lot of trapped energy that's trapped in certain attachments, which he could never avail himself, you see, for use in the higher spheres. So basically, he's crippled mentally. It's not an advantage. Now, it might be true that in certain instances, this defect will result in him not performing an avera. But this is not perfection. This is an accidental thing, just like if a person was on the way to do an avera, they got hit by a truck and wound up in the hospital. So they say, well, it's very good to be hospitalized. You see, the man would have done a terrible avera, would have lost the chayel mabo. This way, all right, it'll take him a couple months, chayel mazah, but, see? So the truth of the matter is that has nothing to do with perfection, and it's just an accidental thing that he avoided avera. But we wouldn't recommend such a thing, because even though he would avoid a particular avera, but it's not in Yadus, it's not particular religious actions that we're interested in, but we're interested in the expression of the personality, that the individual should be able to express himself in a certain type of life, where energy is available to him for use in the higher spheres of human activity. And neuroses prevents this completely. So therefore, it might be a gain in a specific instance, but it certainly isn't a gain in the overall situation. However, the question was raised, if a person was a healthy person, they played sports, and then suddenly they lost the use of their legs, and therefore they were confined to their bed, and they had to do something, so they became a great scholar. Study became a great scholar. Now, if the person could figure out a way to cure himself, should he cure himself or not? Cure himself, he might not study anymore. The answer is, when you say he became a great scholar, what virtue is there in becoming a great scholar? Virtue can only be found in a change in the value system. If he recognized the true value, you see, then, on the contrary, he can cure his legs, and he could, since walking is something which is beneficial to the organism, and the organism will be in a better state, and his energy is directed towards the good, he'll be able to even direct more energy towards the good. Yeah, but if his value system did not change, and he just became a scholar because he couldn't do anything else, so we don't recognize that as being beneficial to the soul. It's just an amount of facts. But the Chazal are pretty clear about that. That a person could be a Baki Bishas, great scholar, Baki Bishas, Poskim, tremendous scholar, and nevertheless, in terms of perfection, it could be worthless. As a matter of fact, you see, that's where you have a conflict between Yadus and Christianity. Right? Because Christianity maintains that you should do that.
What's the difference?
See, they say if your eye bothers you, pluck it out. See, which means that a person should damage his body. A person should damage his body in order to prevent himself from doing transgressions. Because to them, in their simple formulation, it's the action which is the evil. As if there's a certain evil existing in certain actions. That's why cripple your legs, but don't do that action, because that action has like an evil spirit attached to it, so a mystical thing. You know? But yeah, that's not perfection, because if you haven't perfected your soul, so then there is no purpose. As a matter of fact, you're not allowed to harm yourself. A person would not be allowed to do that. because by destroying any part of his organism, he would be preventing himself from ever reaching a higher degree of perfection, because the Rambam maintains, the Rambam says, that a person's health is very important in terms of his total perfection. Because the organism, in order to reach total perfection, the organism has to be operating in the best possible way that it's designed. See? So if you impede it, so then you're going to prevent the person from reaching perfection. The person is not allowed to cause himself yisurim. He's not allowed to harm himself in any way. On the contrary, that's not what he's supposed to direct. In perfecting himself, he's supposed to direct his energies towards changing his values, not towards preventing himself through self-harm to do certain performances. And it's wasted energy. The energy should be directed towards raising his value system, step by step, slowly, little by little. See? Okay. But there is, however, a concept of a person making the best use of a situation. In other words, if something befalls an individual, that the individual should make the best use of that situation. Like if he can't, I would say that a person who was involved in Taivas Olam Hazeh, and something occurred to him, and he became ill, and because of that fact he really changed his value system, and I would say that we must conclude that it was a fortuitous event that occurred to him. A person should use whatever occurs to him to raise himself to a higher level. That's the idea of Kabbalah Sayyisurim. It's the Kabbalah Sayyisurim, but that's not a method of human perfection. You understand what I mean? The reason why it's not a method of human perfection is because if you're going to harm yourself, that means what you're saying is that you're thwarting perfection. I'm intentionally thwarting perfection. What I'm doing is I want to do something wrong, so I'll cut my legs off. So I'm actively thwarting perfection, because I'm not really changing my value system. I'm just avoiding a specific action. That's awesome. But if something occurs to me, which is, you know, something occurs to me that is not in line with my physical well-being, you see, something bad occurs to me in terms of my physical well-being, then I'm supposed to take that event and utilize it to the best of my ability for the self-improvement. but the purpose involved in terms of the man involved, the man's purpose, has always got to be one thing, towards improving himself by changing his value system and not by any other crazy method. Because those other methods really avoid the whole, any other method. If a person decides to harm himself, that means he's admitting that he can't change his value system. So it's an admission of defeat. So that's not perfection anymore. However, if something occurs to him, then he should utilize that occurrence to improve himself. Because he's in line with the human purpose, which is to change one's value system. But any other activity, an activity which thwarts that purpose, is a harmful one. That's why to harm oneself physically would be wrong, would be evil. Rabbi Meir mentioned by Nazir, you have a situation like that where a person can temporarily accept upon himself certain restrictions in order to improve himself. It's true, temporary situation is possible. That's correct, that's right. That's why the carbon is ashachot ala nefesh, because he sinned against himself, to indicate that it's only permissible in a certain situation, temporary. Yeah, that's very good. So the parsha of Nazir really answers this question. The carbon demonstrates that the chait only permissible in a certain situation.
Yeah.
So if a person's religion is just an expression of his psychological conflicts, and you remove his conflicts, you are certainly going to remove his religion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but the thing to do is, what must be done is to replace the motivation, which comes from his psychological conflicts, with true motivation from reality, which means from understanding the ideas of Yadus, understanding the benefits of Yadus, and then what the true philosophy of the system is. And little by little, you can wean him from his psychological motivation to a higher motivation, to a philosophical motivation, but the process must be done very slowly. As a matter of fact, we one time spoke about it. One time said that it's an interesting thing, but you see, in nature, you see a bird builds a nest, right? The way the bird structures a nest is exactly in line with the greatest ideas of architectural engineering in the world. I mean, it's unbelievable. If you ever take a look at how it's built on the bough of a tree, you know, and how it's constructed in such a way that no matter which angle the wind comes from, you know, we'll not be able to remove it. And the structure, every bit of it is made with unbelievable care, and every point is right in its place. Now, the bird has no idea about engineering. Okay? But the bird just follows an instinct. It's attracted to a certain something there in the tree, which causes it to do certain actions. And once it does one action, then another level of instincts come to the fore, and it does the next action, and then the next one. It's programmed. It's programmed to carry out a certain activity. But yet it's in line with reality. It's in line with reality. Now, man also, man's psyche is structured in a certain way. And all these things, the thing of guilt, a person can't obliterate guilt. A person can never obliterate guilt. No matter how much he thinks he knows of psychology or of his own self-analysis. But the reason, in the human being, our instincts, or the way our instincts express themselves and the complexes of the mind, comes out, really, that it's also in line with the reality. Just like the bird's nest is in line with the reality, our instincts are in line with the reality. So that when a person has a feeling of guilt, or a concept of a superego, or a concept of God in an infantile way, in a psychological way, see, which is a replacement of the father, it's true that there is such a psychological structure, and it's also true that God really is not that which his psychological structure refers to. But that instinct in man directs and points to, it parallels a certain reality. It parallels a certain reality. So that he has the ability to remove himself from the initial instinctual form, and it directs him so that he removes himself from the initial instinctual form, and he ultimately winds up with the reality form. So, but it parallels a certain reality. So therefore, human nature, it's not the purpose in Yadis to change human beings, to obliterate their nature. The reason why they're structured that way is for a purpose. The instinctual is sort of following parallel lines with a certain reality, or directing them to a certain reality. But when he reaches a certain age, he should be able to shed it, and then grasp onto the reality. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it is true that a person should take advantage of his own psyche. If a person has a guilt attack about doing an aver, he shouldn't say, "Well, it's just a guilt attack." So you should realize that he might be very fortunate. And the reason why we are structured that way is precisely for that purpose. So because if we weren't structured that way, so then we would never be able to reach the ultimate truth. You see? So the structure of our psyche is created in such a way that we can reach the truth. Exactly. So far as... Right. Somebody like the Rambam is completely, the idea of God being a father figure is completely alien to his psyche. Right. And if you study the matter carefully, you'll see that, no doubt about it. Rabbi Meir Menschel Tambach Svad Gein Meischa, as a machlekes, that a person should never be sure that he's not going to stray from the correct path. So the Gemara in Bracha says, a machlekes over there, whether that is true of everybody. More, I think the Gemara wants to say over there that somebody who was a tzaddik kol yomav could be sure that one mandamahos could be sure they'll never stray. The interesting thing about the way the psyche works, though, you see, there's an argument among the philosophers as to whether, or they call it, as to whether the mind could be overcome completely by the emotion. They call it a rape of the mind by the emotions. That's what they refer to. Both of those. So the thing is, that's the question. The question is, can a person who has total knowledge really ever become overpowered, completely overpowered by his emotions? So you'll say, but you see people always say that I know I shouldn't eat this or I shouldn't do this action, and they do it anyways. So I say that's no kasha. Why? Because if you would talk to the person a moment before they partake of that food, you see, which they know they're not supposed to eat, at that moment, other universal principles are operating in their mind. The food is good. See? Good food is tasty. Tasty to taste something is enjoyable. Enjoyment is good. You see, there are other principles, universals, that are operating in their mind at that moment. So that you might say that the person, in reality, is suffering at that time from a lack of knowledge. This is a big debate among the philosophers. Aristotle maintained that it is possible for the emotions to overcome the mind. Even though a person has an accurate knowledge of reality, but it still is possible. Just like in madness, he mentions madness. Of course, madness is like the unconscious, can overpower the person. At the time, the person, even though he has knowledge, will do something wrong. But he maintains that at that time he will not think it's wrong. At that time he will think that it's right. You see? And he'll become ignorant of his previous knowledge. So it's an interesting thing. When you talk about the structure of the human mind, what you see is like this, that the emotions are really a very overpowering force. And they can overpower all the knowledge that the person has. But yet, the individual cannot operate without the mind. Therefore, the emotions must block out the mind so that certain ideas are not perceived at that time. An interesting phenomenon, the way it works. And which is more powerful, the emotions? So why can't the emotions just cause the person to do the action? No. It's impossible for him to do the action until he loses his knowledge. The emotions are more powerful. So therefore, the emotions are going to cause him to lose knowledge. See? But basically, that's what the pasuk is. Asurim yadel. Now, once he's in that situation, I don't care who he is. He'll be the greatest chacham. But at that moment, he will not be the greatest chacham. That's right. So, exactly. So the only method that a rational person can use to prevent such an occurrence is to use his rationality before that emotion, before the madness sets in. Because when the madness sets in, he's not going to be able to. He's not going to have his mind. I would say this though, that you see, it is possible, really, that a person should have knowledge, and that knowledge itself will prevent the person from sinning. How is it possible? Possible like this. See, when a person, it's only possible in the total state of perfection. If a person is in the total state of perfection, then it means that his emotional desire for pleasure is attached exclusively to the mind. So that whatever the mind determines as the good, because when a person is looking for pleasure, he's looking for the good. Whatever he does, he feels, he has a certain feeling, this is good. Eating an ice cream is good. Partaking of this pleasure is good. Whatever it is, he feels, he has a feeling that this is the good. The feeling, the idea of the good, a person is, one philosopher said that man is a metaphysical creature. Metaphysical creature. Why is he a metaphysical creature? Because whatever he does, he has to have some value system which he operates with. You see? Now, if a person would reach the level where the good to him, that which is good, becomes identified with that which is pleasurable, and this becomes identified with what the mind perceives This is tied to the mind to a very great degree.
You see?
So that his instincts will be directly in line with this reality. Then I would say it's impossible for that person to ever lose his knowledge and to commit an avera, commit something wrong. Why? Because the only way how does it operate that the person commits something which is wrong? Because he has another side of him which is really, the pleasures are really really operating in a different way. He might have an idea of what the good is, but his mind is not the mechanism of the mind is not completely attached to the energy source. So therefore, the energy source overpowers it. It's operating in a different way. But if the mechanism of the mind was totally attached to the energy source, then it would be impossible for him to ever do an avera. Such a thing is conceivable. And I think that's what Socrates meant to point out when he said that when a person does an evil, he is suffering from ignorance. You see, so what did he mean to point out? I meant to point out is that if his mind was constructed in such a way that his energy source was attached to knowledge, then he could not possibly commit that evil. I would say that is really the essential goal of Yadas, for a person to reach that level. You see, where the psychic mechanism is completely, psychic energy is completely attached to the reality principle, and that it does not recognize any good outside of that which the mind recognizes as the good. And then, of course, as was mentioned, there wouldn't be any problem with nearsightedness, because the distance would be the same as that which is near. Rashi's pshat. Rashi says, "Al tarba sicha meisha, v'afilu ishcha shlifisha atam esbatla medivatera. Oishe im basa laharba sicha advarim, tovoi lasapa la machlokes shasisa mechaverecha. You'll tell her the argument that you had with your friend. The daitan shall noshim kalo alayhem, umiyar telech gamhi v'tiskeite itim chavata, eishes chavercha, v'timtzum evili dey bizoyan. Kach mefurish bavas drab noshim shuva meret tzorel. So you'll bring her to v'timtzum evili dey bizoyan. It'll come out that she will get embarrassed, degraded, she'll get degraded. Is that if you had an argument with your friend, so you shouldn't tell it to your wife. Why? Because then she will go and she will fight with her friend, and then it'll lead to degradation. Since she doesn't have a very strong reality principle, so therefore she will get emotionally involved with a friend in an argument, and it'll lead to a bizarre. Okay, what is Rashi saying? He's talking about, you see, the thing is like this. Both Rashi's pshat and the previous pshat, the Rambam's pshat, are talking in the same realm. What is the realm? The realm is the Ruach Mamalala that we mentioned. The fact that man expresses his instincts verbally. Most of his instincts never lead to action. There'd be a lot more murders if they did. Most of them are expressed verbally. Now, however, Rashi's discussing a different verbalization than the Rambam. You see. What is Rashi discussing? Rashi is talking about a case. A man had a fight with his friends. He comes home, and he is tempted to discuss it with his wife. Yeah, so what does this signify? What does the case signify? And he shouldn't, because if he tells her, then something worse will result. Be a worse outcome.
What?
The question we have to ask is, what emotion is he catering to by discussing with his wife?
Apparently, from Rashi, you see, it's not rational for him to discuss this with his wife. But there is some emotion under which he's laboring, which is causing him to do it. Right? What is the emotion? Self-justification. You see, many times what Rashi is pointing out, according to Rashi, what the Pshat and the Chazal over here is, that it's a different kind of talk that they're talking, that they're speaking about. Altar Basicha. It's a different kind of talk. It's a talk, a type of talk that goes on very often among human beings. But not the talk which is directly sublimating the instincts. No. It's a different kind of talk. It's a talk where a person is trying to assuage, trying to ease the sense of guilt that he has with regard to something that he's carried out. And therefore, he talks to his friends. It doesn't have to be his wife. It doesn't mean Badafka. We mentioned before, it's just an example. But it means anyone. Anyone. So he talks to his friends. And why does he talk to his friends? The motivating force behind the talk is because he's trying to justify his own, a certain reality. Which, he's trying to justify or to create a certain reality in his mind, in order to justify his actions. You see? Because many times a person does things or acts in a certain way which it's questionable what he did. He himself knows. As a matter of fact, the reason why he has this talk is because he really senses deep down that he did something wrong. But he's trying to remove it. How does he remove it? By having an objective observer, somebody he considers at least to be an objective observer, agree to what he did. Does he agree with him? In other words, having a seemingly objective observer agree with what he did. And that's really one of the main functions of friendship. Friendship. Friendship, people utilize their friends in a strange way. What they do is like this. They need to have this objective observer. Of course, they can't get an objective observer, because an objective observer wouldn't go along with most of their nonsense. You see? So how do they work it out? They get a friend. Friend is a little bit partial towards this individual. So, therefore, he will go along. He has an obligation to go along. After all, you do the same thing for him when he's in trouble. See, so this mutually beneficial relationship is one which is which creates a situation where an individual can use this friend of his to fool himself, to distort, to bend reality just a little bit, so that he can justify his actions. See, he can justify his actions. Truth of the matter is that this conversation that he's having has no real objective value. On the contrary, it's a harmful conversation. Because by having this conversation, he could be justifying something which is really wrong. And if he'd face it, rather than have this conversation, he'd improve himself. But he can't, because it bothers him, it disturbs him. So therefore, he uses somebody else. And Isha is merely used as an example, because that's the closest friend the person has, and usually that's what happens in these situations. Well, first thing he'll do, he did something, he'll tell his wife to make sure, see what she thinks about it. Let's have an objective opinion. To make sure that I'm right, you see. So that's the type of talk that, according to Rashi, Altar Basicha Ma'isha is referring to. But of course, it's interesting. What Rashi is saying is like this. All right, so then Rashi says, because why shouldn't he do it? Why shouldn't he do it? So Rashi says, he shouldn't do it because it'll lead to Bezoya. Okay, Mevaza or whatever. Yeah, what does it mean? It means like this. It means that really a rational individual, before he speaks, should think, is it worthwhile to make this statement? I mean, is this to convey this information, is there any benefit in conveying this information to this other person? It's a rational person would ask such a question before he speaks. But when a person is overcome by an emotional force, he can't do that anymore. So what happens is that not only does he speak, but he doesn't recognize the possible harmful results that might be the outcome of this speaking. Correct. And it's not just that the case that she'll be misvaza, but many harmful things. Just an example. There are many, many harmful things. Hachayev ha-mamas b'yad ha-lashon. Once a person says something, that's it. Can't take it back. So a rational individual, before he speaks, think over carefully. Is that actually, you see how much emphasis the Torah places on in terms of perfection, not in terms of halacha. The halachic system can't place too much, even though you do have it, you have the kvala, or makarei basasas, lashon hara, but even that, it's not mefurish in the Torah. Because in the system itself, as I explained many times, you cannot legislate perfection. But in terms of perfection, the emphasis that we have in Amasera in the Kisvei Kodesh on speech, the importance of controlling one's speech. Why is it Achayim Mavzi Yad HaLashon? Many, many, many phrases. Nitzol Lashon Mi Yerishach HaTzchayim Avyam Laristev Nitzol Lashon Chameiros Vasach Medava Mirma. I mean, what are all these statements? What does it show? Because the truth of the matter is that a man's instincts, like we were saying, are really backed off. They're backed off from the instinctual performance, but but the next stage that they stop at is the verbal. And it is really a measure of true perfection of the individual as to how he discharges his dibor, his words. That's the real measure of perfection. Because of the fact that the instinctual is expressed, is relegated to the verbal. You see? That's basically the statement. That's basically the Maamar Chazal. But the difference between Rashi's pshat and the Rambam's pshat is that there are two, man operates on two levels. And really there are two components to man. One is a desire, instinctual desire, that area, that's what the Rambam covers. And Rashi covers the other area. There's a backlash against that area. Yetzer Rav, Yetzer Tov. Backlash is a sense of guilt that a person has. This sense of guilt is also one which an individual has to cope with and tries to cope with it through Dibor. That's why Rashi brings in this pshat. Because Rashi shows you Rashi's pshat is in terms of the expression of the instinctual desires. You see? And Rashi shows Dibor, or Rashi quotes the Avos Rav Nosson from Eretz Yisrael. Rashi quotes the Avos Rav Nosson from Eretz Yisrael, shows Dibor not only, that's only one part of man, the instinctual, the one the Rambam covered, but there's another part of man also, another irrational part of man. The irrational part of man that feels a certain sense of guilt and requires justification. There also Dibor is expressed. You see, there also Dibor is a very big factor. That's why Rashi learns the Pshat Tarba Sicha in terms of irrational speech, which deals with that part of the mind, the part of the mind which we call the conscience. So you have both parts of the mind really are taken up in the Mefarshim, although Arvis of Nosim from Yisrael and Aravis, both parts of the mind are dealt with in terms of the Ruach Memalala. Exactly. The reason why the wife is used here is certainly because of the fact that a very important part of the relationship between man and wife is precisely that each one condones the other one's way of life. It makes them feel secure, very good about the way they live. Very important part of the marriage situation. I mean, what's the worst thing is if a man's wife argues and thinks he's wrong and it's considered a terrible breach. Where's the loyalty? Right? So this is recognized universally as being a very important psychological aspect of the relationship between man and wife. That this is one of the functions. So that's why Chazal chose this example. It's a pasuk in the Torah. Pasuk Vayis. What's the pshat? What was part of the motivation? She said, "Vatitain liisha vayechal." No, "Vatitain liisha gam liisha imo vayechal." With her, as I say, she's afraid that he'd marry somebody else. Okay, but the plain pshat in the pasuk is that "Vatitain gam liisha imo vayechal." That she, the moment she recognized that she sinned, she felt very alone, very concerned that she did the wrong thing. So when she insisted that he eats, when he ate, she felt a lot better. It wasn't so bad anymore. Why? Because there was somebody else, another individual, who approved of the same action, which was precisely what she was looking for. You see, so really, you find this open in the Torah, and the Torah speaks about the essential relationship between man and woman. That's part of the reason also why when a person does a chait, he likes to involve somebody else. If Chazal deprecates such an individual, it's not because of the fact that simply they hold he should control himself. Of course he should control himself. But it means he's not on the level where he can handle his own emotions in line with reality. That's the pshat. He's away from reality. The man is not dealing with reality. When a person, the important thing is that a person should have his mind's eye directly on reality, not on what people say to try to justify and distort reality. That's what he's doing. He's involved in the process of distortion of reality. The Chazal were of the opinion that there is no reason for a person, no need for a person to exist in a false reality. A person, the aim of perfection is for a person to face reality head on, to really be able to see exactly live up to what reality is. And distortion of reality is imperfection. It's not a matter of control over here, simply that he can't control his tongue. If a person would just control himself, and that would be the end of it, that also wouldn't be perfection. Perfection means where he doesn't have the need really to control himself anymore, and he works out the problem in terms of what the reality of the situation is and faces the truth of the situation. That's really the level that Chazal wanted to have. I'm asking a question like this. But there's a pasuk in Mishlei that says, Daiga belevish yasichena. That if a person is troubled, he should talk it out, speak it out to a friend.
What?
Over there, it's on the contrary. Over there, he is the one that has a subjective opinion. Because the daiga belevish means it's a personal thing, and it's really, it can be blown out of proportion because of certain emotions that he has. So therefore, if he discusses it with others, so since it's not their problem, so they can see it in an objective way, and then he himself will see it in a more objective way. It's the opposite. But over here, it's just the contrary. Over here, it's he's seeing it also there in a subjective way, but he's not trying to, he's going to further his subjective, his speech over here is to further his subjective view. Over there, on the contrary, it's hard for him to talk, because he's too wrapped up in the problem. So then because it has a subjective force over him, so on the contrary, when he brings it out objectively, so then it'll reduce the power of the problem. Yes. In other words, the case where Rashi's talking about is where the person did something. He committed something which he thinks is a crime, perhaps something wrong. You know what I mean? So therefore, the point is he's not presenting a problem. He's speaking in order to try to justify what he did. That's a subjective type of talk. That's a waste of time. Exactly. But in the other case, he is presenting a problem situation to another person. So, well, it's a personal problem. But he's presenting the problem not in order to, not because he's trying to justify something. It's a problem that he doesn't know. He has no feelings one way or the other. He's trying to present it to the other person. The other person can see it and perhaps help him resolve it. That's a rational thing. That's a rational movement of the mind. You see, but this is the other one is not a rational. It is on the contrary. It is based on the desire to justify what he did. There's a difference between discussing a problem and justifying an action. On the contrary, he doesn't want an analysis of the situation with his wife. He just wants her to say to agree with him. To take his side. That's what he wants. It could be, according to this Girsa, they didn't have Beishas, Halacham Beishas Chaveri. And Rashi says, because Rashi missed the first one, he says, Bavis Rav Nosson Shev Meretz Tzro. Then he says, Bavis Rav Nosson Shev Tzorfas, Mukim Bishtei Nido, Gresh Lo Yoyim Al De'Avero, and then Kavachan Beishas Chaveri, Shiyah. So it seems that the first Girsa didn't have Beishas, because Beishas Chaveri doesn't make any sense. Okay. Point to the first, yeah. The definition of Dait and Kal, right? Oh, yes. Das Kal, what it means when it says, when Chazal said a person's Das is Kal, what it means is like this. It means that the supremacy of the reality principle, the intellect, over the emotions is not that strong. That's what it means. Shlomo HaMelech was able, the question we asked was basically, how could Shlomo HaMelech involve himself with the Taivas, which would be a danger to his soul? Since every Taiva involves a value judgment, which is the corruption of the soul. So he said that such a thing is a philosophical nature, which means that a philosopher is an individual who enjoys observing life, even his own life. He's even a very big observer of his own life. So that a large part of the energy of his psyche goes into the enjoyment of observing, even himself. So he's not really grounded in the taivas. A philosopher will be disappointed very seldom, because he really doesn't have that much energy involved in the particular in his particular activities. A lot of the energy is involved in observing how we what's happening, and even observing his own instincts, you see. Now, of course, everybody has a certain degree of this, and a philosopher has a greater degree, but so therefore an ordinary person, and even a philosopher can't involve himself in taivas, because the other part of him, the instinctual part, will overpower him and will form this corrupt value judgment. But only Shlomo HaMelech was able to apparently have the taivas and suspend his value judgment, because that's what the pasuk says. The pasuk says in Beis Gimel, Tati v'libi l'mshech b'yayin es b'sari, v'libi noeg b'chochma v'lecho es b'sichlus, ad asher ere, eze toiv l'vnei ho'odom asher yasu tachas ha'shamayim mispa yimei chayehem. What is the good? That's what he wanted to say. So, one thing you see the pasuk states clearly about Shlomo, that he was capable of being involved in having everything, and yet that it did not affect his value judgment. There was no corruption of the soul. He was just experiencing and studying the various emotions that were occurring in his mind in order that he should understand them. That's why only Shlomo HaMelech could perform this experiment. Right, that's a good point. There was a commitment on the part of Shlomo HaMelech. It took a commitment for him to involve himself in this activity. See? Most people don't realize it, because as soon as they hear the tithes, it has a certain natural effect, which wouldn't involve too much commitment to try experimentation. See? That's the unique phenomenon of Shlomo HaMelech. That's why it's interesting. But the Chazal never sanction involvement in taivas, except by Shlomo. They said there's one case that Shlomo HaMelech was involved in taivas. You know, why is he the only one? The answer is because he's the only one that was capable of performing such an experiment.
Well, he was a lead joint all the time?
The question is, how could he do this experiment? The answer is, libi noeg b'chochma v'lechos b'sichlas. Because without, if he would leave chochma, of course, then he'd be in jeopardy. So it was a quest for happiness. So he had to decide which way is most beneficial for man. Maybe chochma is not the answer. Chachma itself was really up for judgment in that case. It says that the pasuk says, "V'le'yab alay nashim, v'le'yasu levavai." So Shlema Malach said, "Ani arba v'le'y asa." It says, "No." The truth of the matter is that they did have an effect on it. But what right did he have to say, "Ani arba v'le'y asa"? What right did he have to say it? The answer is because we see was a different type of human being.
By the fact
that he was able to. That he had this ability to do an activity, lechoiz, he had the ability to be libi noyeg b'chochma v'lechoiz b'sichlos. Arash yera, it didn't affect his value judgment. He had that ability, so that's why he said, "Ani arba v'lo yasa." This was what? The truth of the matter is that the outcome wasn't really beneficial, but the claim was justified. Oh, that was Shlomai. Shlomai had that unique ability. That's Shlomai. But nobody else in the world has such a nature. It'd be interesting to know precisely what the fine points of the emotions that he discovered was. But basically, what the psukim mean is a deep insight into the psychological structure of man. That's what it means.
Yeah.
The question was raised as to why did Shlomo HaMelech have to actually involve himself in Tivus in order to prove that the Tivus were wrong. See, there are philosophical proofs. Yeah, but the truth of the matter is there's philosophical proofs, it's true. But what the Pasuk wants to tell you is that he had more than philosophical proof. He wanted to have psychological knowledge of how the instincts operate. You see, in psychological knowledge, you can't have unless you have the particulars. In other words, a person, there are two things. See, a person can know philosophically that a certain activity is no good. But he can't understand, it doesn't necessarily mean that he understands psychologically why he does it. Because he doesn't understand his emotions. But he's two things. So a person can be a great philosopher, but who says he understands how he operates irrationally? See? Point. That's Shlomo HaMelech. That's what the Pesukim are trying to teach us. That Shlomo HaMelech involved himself in the activity, because that means to say that he observed the psychological makeup and how it works. So he had psychological knowledge as well. That's the pshat. Whoever performs the experiment has to have an exaggerated situation. But once he recognizes the phenomena, he can point it out to other people. They can see it also because they have it in their nature too, and they'll notice it. See? If a person only has a psychological, then he really cannot make a value judgment. He can only say how the instincts operate. But he can't necessarily come to a value conclusion. In Kehelis it was a philosophical pursuit for philosophical truth and also for psychological truth. Both. It's both there. The problem really has been down through the ages that philosophers have always told the masses that the way they're living is crazy and they should become rational. Now, the only problem is this, that the philosophers were able to do it because they have a certain nature, like I told you before. Since they have a different type of nature, so they're not really tied, the instincts don't have that much of an effect on them, you see. So therefore, they can't understand why the masses don't listen when you tell them it's rational. But the truth of the matter is that the philosopher himself does not understand why his nature is dragging him to the irrational. But he doesn't bother with that point. He's finished with his philosophy once he sees it's irrational. Okay, now I have to do the rational thing. But why does your nature desire this irrational action? He doesn't understand that. He's not interested in that. That's not philosophy anymore. That's psychology. See? The problem has been that the philosophers could never really affect large amounts of people. Or to put it this way, they couldn't affect anybody that didn't have a philosophical nature. Because the psychological is too powerful and they just were overcome. And so he said, the philosopher always looked at people and was astounded. How could you run after these values? Don't you see that you're unhappy and there's no, it's not aligned with reality and the whole bit, you know? But the point is that the person couldn't see. The person, he might be able to see, but what is he going to do? I mean, he's in the grips of the emotions. The only way that you could really help a person who doesn't have a philosophical nature would be with psychological insight. And that has always been missing.
Yeah.
I don't think it's possible to have a real knowledge of psychology unless a person has has the experience himself. Because the point is like this. The point is you can't identify certain emotions. You won't know what you're talking about. It would be like a blind person trying to explain color to a blind person. Would he be able to understand what it is? I mean, you could probably put together a description, but he'll never know what it is to be able to identify it. And the point is, to have psychological knowledge, a person really has to have had certain experiences. Otherwise, he's not really... It could be a logical structure, like a logical framework, like a study of any logical framework, you see, like a study of mathematics. But he can't identify the entities unless he really experienced them. A person like Russell, at the end of his life, when he admitted, he said that all his previous Principia Mathematica is under the influence of certain principles, which are certain emotional principles, and that's why I read the book. And he says, now it's completely wrong. How could a person give up everything? A person can't give up everything by nature. It's impossible. A person has all his emotions tied into something. He can't possibly budge. How could he do it? How could Russell do it? The answer is, he wasn't even give up. The enjoyment of the observation compensates for the loss. You see? That's the point. He had the ability, that ability to enjoy the observation. The observation was that I was under the influence of these things. See? So that there's a part of him that's always standing back and observing, and which has an enjoyment of observation. That's the definition of a philosophical nature. See, there aren't that many people that have it. It's a natural. There's a certain amount of it as a natural part of a person's makeup, but that's the way it is.
Insult.
Who's Rabbi Shmuel who dashed never yes in the Torah until he said until he came to Eshon Kachapira says all wrong. The observation is the person isn't really that rooted in his own egoistic satisfactions or in his own instinctual satisfactions. Everything that occurs really there's a large amount of energy. It's always in the back observing. So he enjoys the observation of reality. And that observation reality compensates for all the other instinctual losses.
What?
I'll still experience it. He still has a whole lot of the emotion. Not the degree. Not the quantity. Not the quantity. The value judgment is caused by the degree of the involvement. Not the experience per se. The truth of the matter is that's... Yeah, great. So the thing is like this. Greatness as a human being is really greatness as an observer. That's what it is. Every great human being is a great observer. That area is very great. And insofar as being a philosopher is concerned, he has to have an exaggerated area of the observer so that he can really observe the activities which directly involve a possible influence on the self. Okay. Yeah, the truth of the matter is that it's not exactly like the case with Rabbi Yishmael, I think it was Darshan Kol Asin Shev HaTerah, because over there is a question of the enjoyment of truth, the enjoyment of reality. But over here we're saying there's a psychological enjoyment in the self-observation. That's a philosophical factor and there's a psychological factor. Okay. We left off with a theoretical question. I don't know if we'll be able to resolve it, but the question was... That the fact is that when a person partakes of pleasure, so we said that there is a corruption of the soul is involved. The corruption of the soul that's involved is a result of the fact that he loses knowledge. He loses knowledge. Like if a person says, I should not eat that food. So basically, according to knowledge, the conclusion is that this food is harmful to him. Right? Yet we said also that at the moment, if he should partake of this food, or if he should he should want to be. He should be in this right in the moment before he partakes of the food. So at that moment, the other universals will be prevalent in his mind. Namely, the food tastes good. Good food is enjoyable. You see, and he will. That idea that the food is harmful will be removed from his mind. See? He'll be banished from his mind. So he will not have that idea. So you see that that at the moment, that's why Socrates said that at the moment that a person does something which is wrong, he suffers from ignorance. You see? Now, the question that we remained with was, so that's why the corruption of the soul that takes place is that at the moment the person tells himself this is the good. It's a value judgment. In other words, the person cannot really partake of pleasure without telling himself that this is the good. He has to think at the moment, this is really the great thing, this is really the good thing. And that's where the corruption of the soul takes place. Because man has to live with a value system. So man, by nature, is a metaphysician. So he has to live with a value system. So the moment he does something, he must maintain a certain value system. So he has to corrupt the true value system in order to bring his values in line with his action. That's the way it works. The question that we raised was, why is this so? Well, we see first of all like this. We see that the person can't have the knowledge, and the knowledge will be removed from him at the moment. The knowledge will be removed from him at the moment of his action, right? Yeah. So apparently, even though the forces of the desire are very powerful and overcome his rationality, but nevertheless, he can't function without the rationality. So he cannot do the deed until rationally he says that this is the right thing or this is the good thing. At that moment, he's telling the drug addict, when the minute before he takes drugs, at that moment he tells himself this is the right thing, this is a good thing to do. See? So apparently he can't function without the value system. But the value system is not enough to prevent him. In other words, the value system can be overpowered. But when the value system is overpowered, it's not just overpowered, it must be changed. So it's not just overpowered. You can't have a conflict there. So apparently it can't function without a new value system. You know what I mean? And therein lies the corruption of the soul. That's why, that's the danger. That's why chayt is a bad thing. Chayt is a bad thing because it's not just a deed, but it's a corruption of a value system. So the question we asked is like this. The question we asked was that the person, at the moment when he partakes of his particular enjoyment, so the value system that he changes into, right? That new value system, is that a necessary? Is that an essential in the enjoyment itself? You see? Or is it just that he can't tolerate the conflict between his desire and between the other value system? You know what I mean? Or is that really a part of the very enjoyment? That he cannot enjoy anything unless he really thinks. He's looking, what man is really looking for is the enjoyment of the good. So therefore, if it's not the good, there is no enjoyment. So he has to have the enjoyment of the good. There is such a thing in his mind as the good. You see? That which is really ultimately great. And he can never enjoy himself unless he thinks at the moment that this is really the good. Or, no. The only reason why he has to tell himself that is to conform, there shouldn't be a conflict between his actions and between his value system. But inherently, that's not really a part of the enjoyment, the fact that it's the good. But he just has to partake of a particular pleasure. But he needs a matir, so the matir is the switch in the value system. That was the question that we raised. That's right. The converse is also can also be placed in the same
Same question.
In other words, a person's involved in the good and he doesn't know it's the good. He doesn't know it's the good. Definitely it would seem that he would not attain as much enjoyment out of it. And it would seem, or let's put it this way, when he reflects upon his state, he will not have that enjoyment. Reflecting upon his state that he's involved in the good. Definitely, no. And so far as the action is concerned, being involved in the good inherently means that he has a good life. There's no question about that. But the reflection upon the state, which I believe we one time defined as happiness, not correct? Happiness is the reflection on the state? The reflection on the state, when a person reflects on his state, then if he doesn't know he's involved in the good, it would seem that he would lack in happiness. That's what it would seem. If that's the case, then we should really say, then it would seem, at any rate, that when the person, that the change in the value system is because of the fact that a person is not just looking for pleasure, but a person is really looking for happiness. And happiness is not possible without the value change. You see? But the pleasure itself is. So while insofar as the pleasure is concerned, there is no doubt about it, he cannot partake of this pleasure. If his value system concludes that he's unhappy, that would prevent him. He cannot do it. It would be impossible for him to do it. You see? So therefore he cannot possibly do a performance which would in his mind make him unhappy. So he can't do that. So that's why he has to change the value system. But it seems really more than that. That since he's seeking happiness, and happiness can only be attached to the idea of the good, a person cannot be happy unless he thinks he has the good. So therefore, there's a positive aspect to it also. He really wants this to be the good so that he can be happy. Because man really seeks only one thing. Man really seeks happiness. You know what I mean? I just want to mention one point. We're not giving a definition of happiness here. That happiness is reflection. Because in that case, even if it was false, then it would be happy. The person thought he was happy when he wasn't happy, so then he would be happy. That's impossible. So we have the happiness is taken up in another shiur. The basic idea of happiness is where every part of the soul is attaining satisfaction, where the soul is working in harmony, and every part of the soul is attaining satisfaction. That's happiness. That's a separate area. Okay. Therefore, the difference between the philosopher or the good man and the evil man is only in one thing. In what has registered as the good. What in him has registered as the good. That's the difference. Because man basically functions as though everything he does revolves around what that good, quote, good, is defined as. And the difference between people is only what that good is. That's the only difference between people. Okay? Now, Elias, Vav, Yeshua ben Prachya, Venitai, Arbilai, Kiblu Mehem, Yeshua ben Prachya, Omer, Aseh Lecha Rav, Uknei Lecha Chava, Vavidonis Kol Ha'odom, Lekav Schus. Okay. So what is Aseh Lecha Rav? Rashi says it means Shalotahei Atalamad Alaatzmacha Mesvara Elamin Aravim and Ashmua. That's what Aseh Lecha Rav means. You shouldn't learn from Svara. You should just learn Bekiyas. So what's the pshat? What does Rashi mean? The question in Rashi is Rashi says you should learn in Shmua, not in Asvara, right? So the question is like this. The question is, without facts, you can't learn. I mean, anybody that does that, it's not even a good svar. So you could do that. So certainly the svars that follow from that approach will not be any good. What? And if you have, and what's wrong with the svar? I mean, svar is good. The Gemara says, Lama likra svar. Gemara says many times, what do you have to have a pasuk for? What's the svar? So you see that we rely upon reason just as much as fact. To us, reason isn't any less real than fact. The Rambam says in one of his letters, only to a fool, he says, a fact is more real than a theory. He says, but to a theoretician, the theory is the reality. Even more real than the fact. Okay?
Obviously, you must have all the facts before you theorize. You don't have to have a theory without facts. It's ridiculous. That's not even a theory. And once you have all the facts, so then you should have... What was I trying to tell you? You should have all the facts. I mean, that's impossible. Remember... See, Rashi speaks strictly in terms of theory here. Rashi speaks strictly in terms of formulating theories. We cited the ancients, I think. We mentioned that the mistake of the ancients was that they didn't involve themselves in enough experimentation. But they immediately followed along with their theory, the way it would seem, it would seem to be. What does Rashi mean if that's the case? Take a look throughout the ages. We see one thing: that man has always made mistakes when it comes to theorizing because of his presumptuous. By nature, presumptuousness. By nature, he's presumptuous. So he assumes that the next step will follow in line with his reason. His theory in the area where he has the facts is very good. But the only thing is that from there, he's presumptuous, and he makes a move, and he starts expanding without the facts to support him. And the truth of the matter is that science has shown that every time man has done that, he's always made a mistake. The human mind isn't capable of knowing how things are going to be. You see? So this is true in every area. This is true in every era, including halacha. Even a person can be a big goyin and can know how to learn very well one sugya. If you ask him what the halacha is in another area where he doesn't know the facts, there's very, very little chance that he's going to know how it is, because there are new phenomena there. You see? Even though we'll say what's mistaver, another what we're saying is like this. What we're saying is that man's conjecture is in an area where he doesn't really have the facts is worth very little. It's worth very little. You see, chances of being right are very small. No matter how great the thinker is. No, what I'm saying is like this: that man has an ability to reason. You see, man has an ability to reason, but the thing is this: that the ability to reason is limited to within the area that he has knowledge. But once he goes into the area of conjecture. Once he goes in the area of conjecture, the chances of him being in line with reality are very small. He does not have the ability, even though he's very learned, he does not have the ability to simply sense reality because of the knowledge that he's gained. You follow what I mean?
What?
Now, I'm not talking about another area where he has no knowledge. I'm talking about the area where he has knowledge. But once a person goes beyond the facts that he has and he starts theorizing beyond the facts, without facts, you see... Then it's mere conjecture. Do you know what I mean? Mere conjecture, really, human conjecture is really worthless. Human conjecture is really worthless. Because conjecture, the chances of him being accurate, many theoreticians you'll find that they'll, you know, give you theories, and then they don't have an area of conjecture. You know what I mean?
By an educated guess, remember
that? Oh, what is the point over here? So what is he telling you over here? You see? What he's telling you is one thing. Why does a person make that mistake? Why does a person make that mistake? And why does a person feel? What causes even great theoreticians to go astray because of this? Because of the conjecture. One thing. One mistake. You see, because they start feeling. They feel that the gavra themselves. It's that the gavra himself has has made certain inroads into approaching reality. You see? They feel the governor himself can approach... That's right. Now that I am educated in the area, so now I have a certain feel for reality already. See? That's the source of the mistake. That's the source of the error. It's a certain emotion that a person has.
when he becomes learned. So he becomes learned, so he feels he has a right to give a sophisticated opinion. And that any opinion that he gives, because he has knowledge in the area, if it's in line with the way he thinks, or the way he feels, or his theoretical structure, let's say his theoretical structure goes up to a certain level. Now we could take it and expand it, put another theory that would include this, a larger theory, you see? But he doesn't have any evidence for that larger theory. But he senses that since he already is involved in the theory, he's related to, he can perceive reality. See? The mistake is that the person thinks that it's the Gavra that can perceive reality already because the Gavra is educated. You see? But the truth of the matter is that never happens. The only thing that man can do is he can have faith in a certain mechanism. You know, faith in a certain mechanism that can ponder and perhaps arrive at ultimate reality. But to have faith in the fact that since he is one who knows the area, and he's in the area, and he's in contact with certain realities in the area, that since that's the case, so then he could sense what the next reality is. See? That is a mistake. That is a mistake. That's human presumptuousness. See? So one second. So according to Rashi, that's what the memory is telling you. The memory is telling a person that he should never make that mistake and become overcome by that emotional feeling that since he already has a good grasp of the area and perceives realities in the area, that the next universal that he makes, which does not have support from evidence, but which seems to him to be in line with the structure, and it would be very nice if that other universal was there, you see. So it's not just an ignorant guess. An ignorant guess we're not talking about. We're talking about a person who really has knowledge in the area, and the next universal seems to fit in line according to the way he sees with the universal that he has until now. No, he can't do that. He should have no faith in that whatsoever. That's just a matter of conjecture, and human conjecture does not have much of a chance to be able to really perceive the realities. You see? That's what the memory is according to Rashi. As we see through the ages, from all the from Aristotle down, the greatest scientists, wherever, even though the greatest minds and whatever they knew and they had knowledge of, they had sound knowledge of. But the moment they went out of this sphere of knowledge, you see, they made mistakes. They made mistakes because they didn't have any evidence to support what their contentions were, and they just universalized because of the fact that they had a good knowledge of the basics in the area. But their mistakes were because the human mind, when dealing with contemplating the universe, is contemplating something which stems from God. And since it's something which stems from God, he has very little chance to perceive what that ultimate reality is. He only has one thing. He has a certain mechanism that he can have confidence in, that when he sees the facts, he has the ability to universalize within those facts. If he has reached the level at the proper level, and if it's not something that is unfathomable, you know, then within his realm, so then he's capable of arriving at a certain amount of reality. You see, he can approach reality that way, but he could never approach it through that other method. That we see historically in the history of science. You see that is so. Every mistake has been made because of man's presumptuousness. That presumptuousness comes from this emotion. You see, that presumptuousness comes from the emotion that once I know the area, that therefore they assume that the everything else will fall in line. You see, now I'm not saying that the ancients, of course, didn't have any knowledge, any more facts. They would have used the facts. They didn't have any more facts. You see, so then they use conjecture, but the conjecture, conjecture really has very little validity. That's why the Rambam said, with regard to Kadmas Ha'olam. Kadmus HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Rambam says that Aristotle, he doesn't care that Aristotle, even though Aristotle was the chief of philosophers, the greatest philosopher, and the Rambam held he was the greatest investigator that there ever was. In other words, that there ever could be. Let me put it that way. There may have been others equally on his level, But the Rambam held that as an objective investigator, Aristotle reached the highest level. Nevertheless, the Rambam says, when it comes to the fact that Aristotle believes that the universe is eternal, so the Rambam says this was nothing more than Aristotle's conjecture, and since that's the case, he says, and we have a Messiah against it, we will not accept the conjecture of a human being. Because human conjecture is only conjecture. I mean, there's very little chance that he's going to be correct. And we have a Messiah, and so we base our convictions on the Messiah, not on human conjecture. That's what the Rambam says in the second Chelek of the Mara. Okay. The only benefit to that type of conjecture would be, you see, for further further theories possible, for further possibilities, but not if you do it that way. It's one thing if you do it that way, it's one thing, but to believe, to think that it is really reality, that's a big mistake. What Rashi means was when Rashi's element are Ravim and Ashmua, Rashi means to tell you that when it says Ravim, it means Shmua. That's what it means. Definition of Rav in this case is Shmua. Yeah, we mentioned one time that in Halacha, a person can't rely on this type of intuition. Yeah, in Halacha, because that's the way Halacha has it operates with its own framework. There's a special Halachic framework over here. So in Halacha, a person can rely on this type of intuition. Provided he's exhausted all the material, because until he exhausts all the material, he should know that his chances of arriving at the truth are very slim. So therefore, he must exhaust all the material first. Once he's exhausted all the material, he has a right to rely on his intuition. But that's a special license that's given to him in Halacha, because that's the way God wants his Halachic system to work. He doesn't want that we should come to Halachic impasse and not be able to move and not know what to do. So therefore, he gives the Chacham the right to rely on his intuition, even though the intuition, it has very small chance of being correct in reality. But that's a certain halachic right that an individual has. But since we know that it's very highly fallible, so therefore we only utilize it when we have no choice in halacha. But since it's fallible, obviously a person will be a fool to utilize when he has information. You see? But he does have a right to do that. Otherwise he'd never have a machlekes tanayim. So machlekes tanayim means neither could prove either one to be incorrect. You see? So they were relying on their intuition. You reach a point of intuition. They have a right to do that. A person has a right to do that. When you exhaust all the material and all the proofs and all the evidence, a person can rely, a chacham, a person who knows the area, can rely on his intuition. That's a separate right that he has in halacha. You see? He has to recognize that it's highly fallible, but God gave him the right to paskin a din based on that. He has a right to do that. There is such a thing. We're not denying intuition. Einstein made a mistake in the area of the question of the static universe, because the physicist always is looking for a situation in which you finally come down to a static situation. Otherwise, you didn't answer the questions. So you have to find a static base. You see? So Einstein was convinced that there was no creation because of that. And he made a change. He inserted an artificial correction in his structure, an artificial structure into his equations. So in order, really, his equations naturally led to the fact that there is a creation. But he inserted an artificial structure there in order that it should come out the other way. Because he felt that it has to be a static universe. The truth of the matter is, they found evidence, astronomical evidence. And he conceded that it was incorrect. He said that was the biggest mistake he made, because he didn't follow the facts. See? But why? Because of a presumption. A philosophical type of presumption in physics. See? A man has very small chance, even the greatest mind. He was, some consider him the greatest scientific mind there ever was. You know? And yet, you see that man has very little chance, no matter who he is. He's only man. I mean, man has his limitations. Man has inherent limitations. He has a good tool, but it has its limitations. Rambam says that even though the Rambam himself spent a lot of time in the study of science, the Rambam says that first you have to study Torah, because two reasons. Because of the method, Because Torah gives us it's the best way for a person to learn how to think properly, conceptually. That's number one. And two, the Rambam says that it's a prerequisite for Chayal Abba, teach a person how to live properly. There are many mathematicians who live in Madalag Mishugayim. See? So the first thing a person has to do is to learn how to live properly and learn how to think properly. So that's why Allah comes first. The Rambam, even though the Rambam spent a lot of time there, because the Rambam had already reached that level. See, so I'm not suggesting that a person should go and spend his time in physics before he knows Torah very well. But I would say that this amount, a certain amount, the person should know, even at this level, a person should know. So yes, certain things a person should know about the universe. It's important. Hashemayim Asaf from Craig Kell. It's Rashi's chat. Now let's take a look at the Rambam's chat. Ratzaloma afilu lo yeroy liyos l'chorav. It's an interesting Rambam. Aval simo so l'chorav. Rambam is a totally different chat. Simo so l'chorav at shetid meboshu malameid. He says an interesting thing. What does that say, l'chorav? He says, even though this fellow is not really roy to be a Rebbe. Unusual Rambam. He says, make him for your Rebbe. Until you imagine, you should think. Funny thing, you imagine. I mean, is that real? Is that reality? You imagine that he really is teaching you. And because of this, you'll be able to acquire the knowledge. Why? Because when a person learns from himself, it's not the same as if he learns from somebody else. Shalima me'atzmo tovu. Learning from yourself is good. Avalimudo mizulasa yiskayem biyada yosef. But if you learn from somebody else, it'll stay with you more. Okay? Vu yosem avur. That's also more clear. Afilu hoya kamo b'chachma. Olamata imenu. Even though this other person is just as intelligent as you are, or even less intelligent than you. V'chein biur b'firosh zos hamitzvah. Okay? Alright, so what does the Rambam suggest? Sounds like a strange suggestion. You should take somebody who's dumber than you and make him imagine that he's better than you. What kind of a thing is this? What's the pshat in this, Rambam? Yes. It's like a psychological mechanism here that the Rambam introduces, a psychological trick that a person should use in gaining knowledge. What's the psychological, what is the mechanism? How does it work, yes? Well, the Rambam is saying is like this. It's funny. Rashi and the Rambam are both machaven to the same area of man that causes the fallacies. So it causes the mistakes. But two different things. What the Rambam is saying is like this: that since it's impossible to overcome the personal prejudice that a person has towards his own theories, the only way that he could deal with it is to project the theory onto somebody else and imagine that it's the other person's theory, because it's impossible to be objective in that area. Just to say that I'm objective, the fact that it's my theory affects my leaning towards the theory. So therefore, the only way that I could do it is by actually imputing this theory to somebody else. You know what I mean? That's the only way that I could arrive at objectivity. That's what the Rambam says. An interesting thing. So if you're learning with somebody else, even though that other person may not be as intelligent as you, it's a seil chorav. A seil chorav means let him. You should imagine that this is his theory. Let it be his theory. See. In that manner, you'll be able to look at it objectively. It's an interesting device. The Rambam is really espousing over here a certain device that a person should use in analysis if he wants to be objective. So that's what the Rambam says. Okay? This is in line with what the Rambam says. The Rambam wrote a whole thing on the Machla Anushas. He says that there is no human being that can ever overcome the personal overestimation of the self. It's impossible to overcome that emotion, he says. Everybody has it, to some degree. He says, and you can tell from a person's writings what degree it is. The only way a person to overcome this is to take a theory and say it's somebody else's. You say it's somebody else's, so then if he imagines that it's somebody else's, then he'll be able to look at it objectively. That's the mechanism that a person has to use to overcome this human weakness of the attraction to his own theories. That's what the Rambam says. That's the Rambam's shot. It's really the same emotion as Rashi. See, Rashi took off on a different path, and the Rambam took off on another. That's what the Rambam says, Aseh Lecha Rav. You see, according to Rashi, the Aseh Lecha is not really so important. Rambam is Aseh Lecha Rav. Aseh means you should make the person into your Rebbe, even though in fact he's not your Rebbe. But you should do that in order to remove the subjectivism of the involvement and the over-excitement about your own theory. See? That's what the Rambam says. What? If you want to do it practically, you should do it with somebody else. Because to do it just in your imagination is good, but it's not as good. When there's some reality there, it's even better. Let me just explain it a little bit more. You see, what does the Rambam mean over here? Or how does it work practically? It means like this. Ordinarily, if you're learning with somebody that has less knowledge than you, so what that person says doesn't really have too much value to you. You know what I mean? Just say something, doesn't have too much value. What the Rambam is saying is no. Don't just dismiss it because he's less intelligent than you. On the contrary, when he says something, you should think to yourself, you see, that this is a very valuable theory. And you should approach it that way. If you think it's a very valuable theory that he's saying, if you would imagine that this person was a great person that made that statement, so you would analyze the statement. You'd analyze it, you'd give it more credence, you'd analyze it more carefully, right? So the Rambam is saying is that even if the person is less intelligent than you, but if you give credence to his to what he's saying, it could be that what he's saying is really a good theory. Quite possible. See? He may not even know that, but it's less possible that the theory is good. So if you establish him as a Rav in whatever he says, then you have a good chance of being objective about it. Perhaps you're saying a good theory, or what? That's the converse. That's the converse. It works both ways. If you have a theory, so then you should imagine that it's his theory. Imagine this, how would I feel towards this theory if it was his? You see? You're very excited about your theory. How would I feel towards this theory if it was his? You'd dismiss it, right? Well, why would you dismiss it? You see? Why would you dismiss it? And what? Yeah, I would say there'd be practical value in having that person say over the theory to you, and then re-examine it as if it's his theory. I'd say that this is exemplified to a great degree in the Socratic method. See? Socratic method. In the Socratic method, where you take an individual, and what did Socrates do basically? Took an individual in the street, regular person. Who would bother to talk with a regular, plain individual? Ask him abstract philosophical questions. You know what I mean? I mean, who would do that? It's a waste of time. See? Why? In other words, he would examine the contention of the average man. The average plain person has a contention. But this contention, can't you dismiss it because it's not a great figure? Many times you'll find that the simple contention of an individual, even though he's not so learned, but to really understand and break it down to see why it's not correct, requires a lot of chokhmah. So what you have to do is, as a method, you have to take this contention as a simple one. You know what I mean? And see if you understand it. So as a Selech HaRav, that's what I mean, as a Selech HaRav, you're taking this person who's really ignorant, and you're making him into a Rav. You're saying, let's see what you're saying. You have something important to say. Oh, is this it? Okay, now let's examine it. You see? So that leads to understanding, to knowledge. That's the method, really. That's the method. The method is not to debase any proposition, no matter who it comes from. See, unless you see that it's inaccurate. but the because it comes from somebody else. On the contrary, build it up. Build up the proposition. Yeah. Asay l'chor rav means that the statement that he makes, even though he's more ignorant than you are, should be rav, has a value. Look at it as if it has a value. And through that method, you'll find that knowledge will open up. You know what I mean? Don't despise anything that a person says because he has less knowledge than you. The idea might have a nucleus of something valuable there. Consider it very important and proceed to analyze it. That's the point. Don't just dismiss it. Truth of the matter is that somebody who has that method, I believe that somebody who has that approach, somebody who has that method, can really gain. Many times people say that they can't.